Tonight's talk is on wise concentration. This will be the last Dharma talk in this series on the Eightfold Path, which many of you have been following as an 8-month course with practice guides and teacher support. I'm amazed, really, to think that we're really done. But of course we aren't. The Eightfold Path will continue to lead us to freedom, both on a daily basis as well as a potentially total liberation from dukkha or suffering. Concentration is a necessary part of all forms of meditation, at least in the Theravada tradition. It enables us to control our attention, which really, when it comes to suffering, is the most powerful tool we have. So it's the means by which we cut off the states of mind that torment us and cultivate those that deliver us to peace, joy, and wisdom. As every day as concentration is to regular practitioners, it can be very misunderstood. I cringe whenever I hear new students told to begin by clearing the mind. It's like telling a very upset friend to just let go of it. Only very rarely can anyone just jump into a clear mind or having let something go. Both of these states are results of a process, and this instruction completely misconstrues that process. We achieve concentration by paying attention. We do this during the day, either as part of our regular mindfulness meditation or daily life practice, or when something interests us. Interest is a wonderful fuel for concentration, so it should be encouraged, particularly if it comes from a happy place rather than from fear, which certainly can happen in the workplace. When we're mindful of doing some chore, we're focusing attention to identify what steps are involved in that task and to execute those steps correctly. That part of mindfulness is a form of concentration. The kind of concentration which is the eighth part of the Eightfold Path is different. We're talking about concentration practice, which calls for deeper and more sustained concentration than we need for mindfulness. This deep concentration is the practice that clears the mind. But that isn't achieved by our willing that clarity into being. Instead, we take specific steps to create conditions that will cause the mind to clear. It isn't magic, and it's also not something that happens just because we want it to. This might be a good time to ask why we might want to concentrate. And another good time is after you've tried for half an hour and the mind is still jumping around like a box full of rabbits, we do need to apply ourselves with enough energy and determination to outlast those hopping bunnies. But what for? Well, two reasons come to mind. First, once achieved, concentration is wonderfully pleasant. It calms and clears the mind. This does for us what it did for the young Buddha, Buddha-to-be, when he accompanied his father on a business trip. While his dad was talking to some people, the boy sat relaxed and alert under a tree and just let go of any cares. That's the formula for concentration, being relaxed, alert, and letting go of clinging, at least in the moment. The young prince became so deeply concentrated and felt such delightful peace that the experience served as the guiding star for the rest of his practice. He knew after that it was possible to rest in such freedom and happiness, and he continued to work toward it until he achieved nibbana. The experience of deep concentration is a potent motivation to continue our practice. The second reason to practice concentration is that it can be a powerful tool to cut out the root cause of all of our suffering. So, yeah, it's a big tool in the box. There are two routes to end dukkha. There's the daily noticing of when dukkha arises, what it's like, what caused it, and then how it can be ended in the moment. And through this process, we root out layer by layer our harmful mental habits. We practiced this in the sixth part of the path a couple months ago. It was called wise effort. The other route uses very deep and sustained concentration to move the mind beyond its clinging to the delusion that we exist as separate and continuous things. Now, for years, I've been using physics and English grammar to convey why that belief is a fallacy, by saying we are verbs, not nouns. In fact, though, this great truth defies explanation. It does help to logically accept that it might be true, but to truly realize anatta, or not self, it has to be experienced. Deep concentration can give rise to that experience. In the Bahya Sutta, a highly respected, long-time practitioner went to the Buddha during alms round and asked how to be fully liberated. The Buddha tried to put him off until after the alms round was over, but Bahya protested that he didn't know how long he was going to live, and he felt the need to know at once. The Buddha instructed him this way: when for you there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then, Bahya, there is no you in connection with that. When there is no you in connection with that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of stress. Bahia got it and was fully enlightened on the spot. As he walked away, he was, indeed, killed by a cow. And the Buddha had the Sangha honor Bahia as someone who was totally unbound, completely liberated from dukkha. Now, Bahia had the best teacher ever and enough practice and motivation to realize the truth behind the Buddha's words. Others of us need to soften the rigidity of the mind around this issue of anatta, and concentration can do that for us. I'll discuss more about how that's done in a little while. Before I do that, let's look at how we get concentrated. I don't know if any of you felt a moment or a few of concentration during the sitting, but it is possible, however long you're sitting. It is a process, like training a puppy to settle down. You pick it up and physically put it down, saying, "Sit." Then you point to it and say, "Stay." And you repeat this over and over until finally the puppy stays. Then it gets up and you start over. This can be tedious, and you're repeatedly tempted to declare that dog untrainable and give up. But you stay calm and patient and keep it up with sit and stay. In Pali, the word for telling the mind to sit is vitaka, and the word for stay is vichara. The mind, like the puppy, has to be told to be here on the breath. So we sit the attention down on the breath. We do this consciously with a little bit of, or however much, effort it takes. The less, the better. It takes determination to focus the attention on the body breathing, taking an interest in the breath that keeps us alive will help. So will the fact that focused attention is a lot more pleasant than a jumpy mind. And finally, we can use mental exertion. So our tools are interest, pleasure, and exertion. Once the mind is sitting on the breath, then it has to stay there. That means resisting any urges to move the attention elsewhere. Interest, pleasure, and exertion will help in this effort also. So that's vitaka, sit, and vichara, stay, over and over. Let me note that there are a lot of objects besides the breath that we can focus our attention on. Bhikkhu Bodhi mentions 40 of them. I know, don't try them all in one night. You can take your pick. Mostly, I refer to holding attention on the sensations of breathing because I've used that all the way through my practice, and it works fine for me. But feel free to use whatever works for you, and you're welcome to refer to Bhikkhu Bodhi's book on the Eightfold Path under concentration, where you'll at least get a list of some of them, some of those 40. It just takes time and repeatedly coming back to the breath for the mind to finally just stay there. It also requires seclusion, away from interruptions, like on a retreat. This period of repeated sit and stay has been called the surf zone. It's like we're trying to wade past an area of breaking waves that keep knocking us off balance. Beyond that, it gets smooth. So we try to stay focused during the surf zone, and then wham, some thought bumps us off our concentration on the breath. So we put our attention back and settle onto the breath. And if we keep doing this, eventually we will get out deep enough to where the waves just weaken and stop. And when we're past the surf zone, there are just no more thoughts strong enough to interrupt the focus on the breath. To get through the surf zone, a lot of people use only willpower and mental exertion, which is exhausting. And it can also be counterproductive, keeping us too tense for the mind to settle down and wearing us out and getting us discouraged. Gil Fronsdal recommends that we think about getting concentrated as a process of letting go of distractions rather than pushing them away or forcing the mind to hold on to the breath. As we keep letting go, the mind gets lighter and lighter. We get used to coming back. We stay a little longer. We are relaxing into not thinking, resting on the breath. I mentioned earlier that the formula for concentration practice was being relaxed, alert, and letting go of clinging moment by moment. We're settling into just being with the breath. And this approach holds more relief, appeal, and pleasure while we're doing that work in the surf zone. And that mental pleasure and a sense of well-being that comes with it are key ingredients in a sustained state of concentration. We can cultivate this mental pleasure by knowing it's possible and noting when it arises. It's like during a meteor shower, when we go out, look up, and we just stay alert for that instant of light zipping across the sky. It always gives me a little thrill of pleasure to see that. We can't make meteors happen, and we can't make the pleasure of contentment, of concentration, arise. But the more we notice when they do, contentment and pleasure, the more they grow. And they help bear us through that surf zone and into a state of deep concentration. One such state is called samadhi, which is very pleasant, very serene. In samadhi, we're no longer struggling or even trying to come back to the breath. We're just there. Thoughts may arise, but they don't distract us. The hindrances may arise, but they don't break the peace. We're like the young Buddha under that tree, happy in a way that requires nothing from the material world. And there are the jhanas. These are states of concentration that are self-sustaining and unhindered. It may take quite a lot of wading through the surf zone to develop enough concentration to access the jhanas. For me, at first, it took a couple of weeks of sit and stay before I experienced the first jhana. So it does help to be on retreat. There are 8 jhanas arising as a process of refinement of the mind. The first jhana includes vitakka and vichara, just a little bit of sit and stay. And it's accompanied by physical pleasure and happiness. In Pali, piti, P-I-T-I, and sukha, S-U-K-K-H-A. These elements sustain the jhana and unify the mind on the breathing. So it's a one-pointed concentration, just the breath. And this develops an unshakable confidence. The hindrances no longer arise, and vitakka and vichara fall away. And we can then enter and dwell, as the suttas put it, in the second jhana, filled with pleasure and happiness. For me, piti, that pleasure or rapture, it's often called, is so powerful that it can be pretty hard on my nervous system. In the third jhana, piti drops off, and the mind is just happy and equanimous. In the fourth jhana, the happiness blends into pure equanimity. So as I said, these 4 jhanas get progressively refined. There are some tremendous benefits to practicing with the jhanas. There's a kind of mythic air about them, When I started practicing Vipassana, Theravada teachers were barely willing to talk about them, and very few would agree to lead students through them. Some serious long-term practitioners have never been able to access the jhanas, but they are very real, and more people are working with them. It's important to have guidance from an experienced teacher who is experienced in leading students through the jhanas and can keep us from straying into delusion. It's something quite possible without guidance. But with it, these deep states of mind can give rise to invaluable insights into the origins of our dukkha and how to end it. These insights don't occur while we're in the jhanas, but afterwards. And that's pretty much true with insights arising from our mindfulness meditation. Usually they're later. Sometimes we think that the effects of our practice have worn off, and we don't attribute the insights that arise to our practice. Our new confidence in the practice, though, continues uninterrupted and undiluted. There are four more jhanas in which we go on refining the very way we perceive phenomena, and they unify our awareness beyond ordinary modes of understanding. That's a mouthful of big words, which mean that we acquire very different ways of thinking and relating to what is. This undercuts our clinging to the way we think of I, me, and mine. So after jhana practice, we're still able to see things in the normal way, but we also know this other dimension of truth. And we're well on our way to liberation from all dukkha. There's one more form of concentration I want to tell you about, particularly since this has been the focus of my practice in the last several years. So far, we've covered those moments when the mind becomes concentrated during our daily meditation, samadhi, and the jhanas. This last form of concentration doesn't get mentioned very often. It's a practice that Bhikkhu Bodhi calls momentary concentration. And he says it's a continuous, concentrated awareness of whatever enters the range of perception, clinging to nothing. That's always an important element. Like the jhanas, this momentary concentration can lead to wisdom and the last stage of the path. I intend to say more about that last stage when I talk about liberation on June 30th. That's kind of a bonus. There is so much to learn about concentration. Very big books have been written about it by many people. I recommend that you learn by doing it. When I sought out Gil to be my main teacher and mentor, I told him that I wanted to develop concentration, but of course, I was being careful not to strive too hard. He suggested that I try just a little harder. So I applied more energy to concentrating in my daily practice, and I went on longer retreats. Seclusion really is important. It can be found at a retreat or in a camp in the woods, which is the way I do it a lot, or a day-long retreat, or a quiet room in your home. I have learned over my years of practicing with concentration that the benefits of it are real, not just something that's written in a book by a scholar. Now, I brought handouts with practice guides for this final part of the path, and they'll be available online too. You can add these exercises into your daily practice, just the way it is. Just add these in and develop concentration while you're meditating. It doesn't have to be the whole time. These practice exercises will also help you use whatever concentration arises to explore more deeply the truth of how things are. Now, maybe practicing concentration in seclusion has no appeal to you, or it seems like a big investment in time to go on retreats or practice concentrating. Mindfulness could be serving you well enough, and that's fine. Really, the best time to go on retreat, to practice concentration, is when you want to. Then you'll be ready. And on that day, I wish you the best this practice has to offer. Thank you.